first day after Simchas Torah. Now we have about almost 2 months, approximately, in fact, almost to the date, to the next Jewish holiday of what, of course? Hanukkah, which is a mini holiday compared to what we just went through. And as such, I was wondering what we can do to fill in the time. And since I have to stall for time in between Mincha and Maariv to make sure we daven at the right time, it's a dilemma. It's a very big dilemma. On the one hand, you have to be brief and short and sweet and to the point, or else no one's going to come. And on the other hand, you have to fill in the time. So what are we supposed to speak about? What I thought of speaking about was a fascinating subject, in my opinion. You can, of course, disagree. And that's the subject of being Jewish, or to be more precise, who is a Jew? Ultimately, we just went through a holiday period of which every single holiday came out in the middle of the week. Many, many Jews around the world had to take off from work, had to maybe miss great business deals, not tune into the stock market, not be part of it, because of Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot and Shmini Atzeret and Simchas Torah all came out inconveniently, if I can use that term, in the middle of the week. And that, of course, is a very Jewish thing. The fact that you have to take off for work for Yom Kippur. Who is a Jew? Who is subjected to these laws? And what I want to speak about for the next few weeks is a very general topic that touches many facets of life. First of all, very simply, who is a Jew? One who is born to a Jewish mother. Of course, you can ask the question, why not a Jewish father? Why did they pick a mother and not a father? And the truth of the matter is, there's a minority view in the Talmud that says it might be the father. That view wasn't accepted halachically. Halachically, it goes by the mother. But ultimately, the reason the view wasn't accepted was because the mother is much more important in Judaism than the father. To be more precise, women are much more important than men in Judaism. Jewish law gives a lot more credit to women than men. And as such, it seems to mean that not only is Jewishness determined by the mother, but many other laws are determined by the mother. For example, you make a mishabeirach, someone's sick, unfortunately. You go up to the bima, it's a Shabbos, everybody's listening. He who blessed our ancestors, Rabbi Yechez, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, bless and heal Shloimi, the son of father or mother?
Mother.
When you make a mishabeirach for someone that's sick, you go by the mother. By contrast, you're calling up someone for an aliyah, he hasn't had an aliyah in years, he forgets his Hebrew name, you say, Shloimi, the son of the father. Kohen, Levi, or Yisrael, determined by the father. Namely, which status, quote-unquote, of the Jewish nation are you? That's determined by the father. But life in itself, are you Jewish or not? Are you alive or not? Namely, are you Jewish or not? And are you alive? Or if there's some threat to your life by the mother. The mother is considered the savior or the guardian of life. And therefore, she determines if you're Jewish or not. And ultimately, she also determines your actual life. When you're someone sick, we say, please heal him, son of the mother. He came out of the mother, that's what we do. I'll give you one more example, very important example. Because everybody here knows, based on which baby you have, how much money you're going to put out right away. How much money do you have to shell out when a baby's born? Everybody knows you don't want kids because kids are money. You've got to spend money on kids, right? So, you finally decide to have children, the baby is born. How much money do you shell out? In the non-Jewish world, I'm sure, it's the same amount of money. Cribs, give me out. You have to buy a crib. What else? Diapers, wipes, toys, clothing. They spit up on the clothing. You need the schmutzes. A lot of stuff to buy. Now, the Jewish nation has a little bit of a division if it's a boy or a girl. Why? If it's a boy, 8 days after the birth, a bris. If it's a girl, you want to make a party, God gave you a girl, I made a party, God gave me a girl. How long after she was born did I make the party? A month later. Let the money come in first, let the presents come in, gain a little interest, then we'll make the party. If it's a boy, you better have the cash ready. Now there's one more little knetch. Let's say it's not only a boy, it's a firstborn boy. And let's say that firstborn boy is the firstborn to the mother. What do you have to do? Not only a bris, but what's called the pidyon haben. What's a pidyon haben? You redeem the baby from the kohen. Now, that particular law is not something that happens frequently. Anybody know why? There's been babies born since I've come to Halifax. Never once was there a pidyon haben. Does anybody know why? First day born, first of all, how many babies, percentage-wise, Dr. Perlin can probably help us, percentage-wise, how many babies are girls and how many are boys? 50-50? So 50% of the births you're not going to have a pidyon haben, correct? Or a bris. The other 50% you're going to have a bris, maybe not a pidyon haben. What else do you need for a pidyon haben? Money. Let's assume we have the money. Huh? You need a kohen. Let's say we have a kohen. Let's say the baby who's the firstborn is now a son and to a kohen. Does he need a pidyon haben? His father's a kohen. No. If he's a son to a Levi, does he need a pidyon haben? No. Right away, you're knocking out the 50%, you're going down. Now, if the mother's the daughter of a kohen or a Levi, you knock down that too. Add into this that if the baby's not born naturally, but it's born through a cesarean, no pidyon haben. My firstborn son, cesarean, no pidyon haben for me. I was happy. Less money. Gentlemen, not only that, let's say, God forbid, this is not the firstborn, but rather it was a firstborn that actually was born. There was a stillborn. There was a miscarriage. You knock that down. So to have a pidyon haben is not so frequent. Now, pidyon haben goes by the firstborn to, anybody know? Father or mother? Father. Hmm? Mother. Mother. Gentlemen, it's very, very important. Life goes to the mother. So the first thing when you say, who has to take off for Yontif? Jewish mother. Very important. It's very consistent within Jewish law. Life in itself, you're Jewish and you're alive, goes by the mother. Other laws might go by the father. God willing, Sunday we're going to pick off by the second kind of person that's Jewish. And of course, who's that? You're not born Jewish. Can you become Jewish? A convert. What's the third category? Now it's really going to get tricky. It could be a third category. You're not a convert. You're not born to a Jewish mother in a natural way. What can it be? I'll give you a hint in three letters. A, I, D. A, I, D. Huh? Yeah. No, not adopted. That was a convert. Let's say this baby was not born through the normal way a baby is born. Husband and wife love each other, they make a baby. No. Artificial insemination. Is the baby Jewish or not? Who else can be a Jew? A convert. Conversion. And before we get into who's a convert and what does a conversion involve, namely, how do you change your status from a person that's obligated in 7 commandments only, all of humanity, to someone that's obligated in 613 commandments, which is specifically the Jewish people, I want to say one preliminary comment about conversions. In the Talmudic sources, how much material do you think is devoted to conversions?
Books.
Books. Any other guesses? Maybe a few pages. And I'm exaggerating. I'm going to be nice. Why? I mean, conversion, this is a serious operation. This is almost as big as it is for a man to become a woman. I mean, this is what Michael Jackson goes through on the one hand, and Donna International on the other. I mean, you're taking someone that's absolutely not Jewish, and you're converting them to a religion in which they're overnight, from some dip in the mikvah, they're obligated in 613 commandments. They go from 7 to 613. That's a jump. Only a few pages? Now, let's make that a little more complicated. How many conversions do you know of people that faked out the rabbi, as we say? Yeah, they converted. The minute they converted, goodbye, Charlie. Have a good night. We'll never see him in shul. We'll never see him contributing to Jewish thought, to Jewish causes. We'll never see him in any Jewish environment. You don't think there would be endless literature devoted to this issue? How come there's only a few pages in the Talmud? What's your guess? Why do you think there's only a few pages devoted to it in the Talmud? Yeah. Absolutely. Why in God's name would you want to become Jewish in the times of the Talmud? What would you gain out of it? It wasn't in fashion to be a Jew. You didn't have Madonna's learning Kabbalah then. It was a totally different world. Okay, being Jewish was not in fashion. As a matter of fact, the law is, and this is in a few pages of the Talmud that devotes to the issues of conversions, when a convert comes and says, I want to convert to Judaism, what's the first thing you're supposed to say?
No.
Don't you? No, 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 no. That's a misconception. You never say no. You don't close the door. But you say, why did you want to come to convert? After all, don't you know that the Jewish nation is oppressed? We're going through pogroms, blood libels, terrible tragedies. Why would you want to subject yourself to be part of it? And that wasn't just a statement that rabbis obligated to say. That's a truthful reflection of life. Who would want to be a convert? However, in the last...
Could often is for personal reasons.
And that is, and is something that changed.
I know converts that come to shul more regularly than born Jewish people.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a second. That's a very important point you're making, that you're bringing up. And that is, in essence, something that changed in the last 50 to 100 years. All of a sudden, you have converts that want to convert to Judaism because they want to be Jewish. They think it's a fashionable religion. After all, it happens to be a religion that, if you think about it, really legitimizes life as life. You don't have to take sacraments. You don't have to go ahead and say, I need to lead a life of poverty. I want to lead a life in which I will never get married. No, we sanctify life. We sanctify food. We sanctify sex. We sanctify all the aspects of enjoyment in this world that we have. And therefore, it happens to be a religion that might be fashionable. Secondly, let's not forget that in the last 50-some years, it's a little more safer to be a Jew. Correct? A Jew, to walk around with a kippah, to demand you're taking off for Yom Kippur, is not something that's out of the ordinary. So in the last 50, 100, 150 years, all of a sudden the literature on conversions went up a notch. But in the classical Talmudic sources, very, very little. It was almost an irrelevant case. Okay? You could probably count the conversions of the Jewish nation on two hands, and that would be it. And you'd know who the convert. Now, once a convert becomes a convert, and we'll discuss tomorrow night how exactly that happens, ultimately, is that person considered a full-fledged Jew, lock, stock, and barrel? Anyone think otherwise? No. Very good. If you're a true convert, you're an absolute Jew from the moment you become a convert. Finished. There's no two ways about it. As a matter of fact, very interestingly, for some reason in the Torah, it says, "V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha." You shall love your fellow Jew as you love yourself. Whatever that might mean, we explained it a few times last week. What does it say with regard to a convert? Not only should you love your fellow convert, because it's a fellow Jew like yourself, there happens to be specific commandments of Ve'ahavtem et ager. You have to love the convert more than you love your fellow Jew. There's stories about great rabbis. I know a story about a rabbi. Every time he met a convert, he kissed and hugged him. Finally, they ask, you're not such an emotional guy. How come you're kissing and hugging? And you know, nowadays when rabbis kiss and hug, you know, God forbid, you're going to start thinking they have tendencies to the wrong sex. So why are you kissing and hugging? He says, for two reasons. First of all, you have to love your fellow Jews, so you give a handshake. You say, Shalom Aleichem. But the second thing, you got to love your convert, so you got to kiss and hug him. There's specific commandments in the Torah to love a convert because they're, in essence, breaking with their past, breaking with their original culture. And that's something that you and I didn't do. We were born into it. But a convert that goes ahead and takes a total change is on a much higher level, quote-unquote, than I would say a Jew that's born into it. And that might explain what Lawrence just brought up. And that, of course, is the issue of, well, once sometimes you have a convert that's so much more devoted to Judaism than a frum or a Jew from birth. Definitely. And that's maybe the reason why the Torah is so careful with the convert. Constantly, positively strengthen them. Love the convert. Don't, God forbid, hate the convert. The convert's a full-fledged Jew, and the Torah reiterates this point time and time again. Got a question?
Well, I thought you weren't even supposed to be a non-convert in previous status.
Okay. Correct. Correct. Not just the convert, even someone that's returning to Judaism. You're not supposed to remind them of their past, because that, of course, can be very detrimental. On the other hand, you definitely have to check if they're really breaking with their past. And we'll deal with it tomorrow night. I'll just give one little story. Although, you know the story, I know the people involved, unfortunately. Sometimes I'd rather not know the people involved. But for this particular story, I know the people involved. Not saying names. It didn't happen in Canada. But outside of Canada somewhere, a convert was learning with a rabbi for a very long time. And it seemed like this is going to be a good conversion. They're about to go to the mikvah. And the night before, there's a little reception at the rabbi's house. And this person's already part of the community, so they invited her to come as well. And during this meeting, someone, I don't know, said something derogatory about Jesus. And this convert began to cry. Why are you crying? How can you say that about Jesus? Thank God, the rabbi was very, very smart not to convert that girl. Obviously, she didn't totally break off with her past to the extent that she still believed that Jesus is either the Son of God, if not the Son of God, then maybe the Grandson of God, if not the Grandson of God, then something else. All these wonderful stories, and ultimately, that's a very important point. You don't remind them of the past. You definitely, on the other hand, have to make sure that they're totally broke with their past. How much do you have to break with your past? Do you cut up connections with your parents? In my opinion, not, but that is an issue. How do you convert someone? How much time? Now, what is a conversion? He explained briefly a conversion means that you basically transform who you are. You were originally a human being. Obligated in how many commandments?
13.
Seven. Seven Noahide commandments. This week's Parsha delineates them as well as last week's Parsha. Noah, as well as all of humanity that developed after the flood, is given seven commandments. Those are the expectations of God from every human being. I can promise you that most human beings out there are fulfilling the seven commandments without even knowing about it. Because they're very natural. They're what we call commandments of morality. For example, not to kill, not to steal, have a judicial system and to live by it. These are all commandments that you're doing anyway. And that's what God asks of every human being. Except, of course, for who? Shelley. Except for Shelley and me and everyone sitting here and every Jew in the world. God asks of us a few more commandments. 613 to be precise. So all in all, how many commandments more do we have than every other human being? 607. 607 more than every human being. Take your word for it. Gentlemen, how do you transform your identity from going from one that's obligated in 7 to one that's obligated in 608? How do you do it? As I said, in a very small amount of Talmudic sources dealing with this subject, we go out and see what we need to do. Conversions existed. Ruth was a convert. Ruth, the Megillah we read on Shavuos, was a convert. In the times of David, there were conversions. There were always conversions. But ultimately, the Talmud goes out and delineates what you need to do. First of all, the convert comes to the door. I want to be a Jew. What's your immediate response must be? I don't like to use that, Jack. No, like an evening.
I assume.
To be more precise, even before, are you sure? It's in between these two extremes, actually, I like to say. I don't think the response of the Talmud is get lost, but rather, are you crazy? Let's just change it a little bit. Are you out of your mind? Do you know what the Jewish nation goes through? Anti-Semitism. Of all sorts, shapes, and sizes. You want to become part of this nation? And of course, the Talmud doesn't say this, but I would add in, you're obligated in 7 commandments. Yours truly is obligated in 608 more. You want to be commanded in all these things? You warn them. You're telling them nuts. If after this warning, the person goes out and says, and I quote from the Talmud now, well, Sandy, I still want to be Jewish. Then I say, you ask what David asks. Are you sure? Right? And then after they say, yes, I'm sure, in a very subtle way, you give them the feeling that maybe what Ralph was saying, get lost, in the sense of, hey, go think about it. Yeah, I know you want, go think about it. Sleep on it. Come back after the weekend. I had a lady last week, came into my office, I want to convert to Judaism. I said to her why, I gave her the whole story. She basically is a lady, unemployed right now, looking for something to do, if you know what I mean, to occupy her time. I didn't want to say that. So she says, I want to be a convert. How do I begin? That's it. I gave her all the warnings, anti-Semitism, gave her all the horror stories, told her about fasting on Yom Kippur, didn't help. Told her about keeping kosher, didn't do the trick. Shabbos, no problem. What do I do? You got to move from darkness to Halifax? I'll do it. So what did I say after all that? I said, think about it. Take the weekend. Today is Monday. We are past sunset on Monday. I haven't received a call, and I hope I don't prosper specifically, because I really don't think that that particular lady took into consideration all the scenarios about being a Jew. So, that's a very important thing. Think about it.
What was her age bracket?
Huh?
What was her age bracket?
No comment. Middle-aged. Okay. Okay, guys, come on in, please, please, please. Well, that might be in a few minutes. Go right ahead. Okay. Gentlemen, one step further. We have a few minutes so we can dive in Meyer, and we'll just finish with this. Gentlemen, once the convert is supposed to be a convert, whatever it is, the rabbi, the court decides, yes, you're going to be a convert. What does the convert now do?
Go to a mikvah.
Not yet. Going to a mikvah is the last stage. It's a very simple stage. Not so simple, but simple.
Learn.
Why do you got to learn?
Learn Hebrew.
Learn Hebrew. What else?
Well,
very interesting. First of all, Jewish law. But very interestingly, the Talmud doesn't give a full curriculum. It gives a general curriculum. Let's give the examples the Talmud gives. It's perplexing. Really amazing. The Talmud goes out and says, You tell them about a few mitzvot. A few mitzvot. If I can use the word zammo, the in mitzvot mitzvot kalot, or mitzvot mitzvot chamurot. You give them a few of the harsher commandments and a few of the easy commandments. No? Anybody know what the easy commandments are? Or what the harder commandments are? How do we weigh commandments? So tonight we'll just give one little part of it and tomorrow we'll continue. With regard to prohibitions, the answer is very simple. How do we weigh them? Prohibitions of the Torah, the don'ts. The don't do this and don't do that. How do we weigh what's more severe? Based on what?
If it's in Torah or not.
No, let's say they're all in the Torah. They're all biblical or rabbinic. Okay, you know what? We'll take that first division. Biblical and rabbinic. Now, if they're biblical, how do we weigh them? Obviously, not how to do all of them, but how do we know what's severe and what's not?
Severe and punishment.
Based on the punishments, that's right.
Based
exactly. There's a different punishments within the Torah. Not consequences per se, but I'd say punishment for sure. First of all, there's a terrible punishment called the Jewish court can execute you. That's the worst punishment in the Torah. Okay? Violator of Shabbos, terrible things. First, secondly, you slept with a married woman. These are terrible things. Punishment is awful. Secondly, what's the second?
Karet.
What's karet? Anyone know? Karet means being cut off for the Jewish nation. This is the punishment for eating chametz on Pesach, for not having a bris. This is the punishment for eating on Yom Kippur. This is a punishment for certain sexual immoralities. It's not excommunication. It's God will cut you off from the Jewish community. God will make sure that you die early. In other words, as opposed to the court killing you, God will kill you in his own time. Hurled. Anyway, that's the second kind of punishment. The second level. What's the third level? Huh? Malkot. Jewish court can give you 39 lashes. That's the third kind of punishment. And those are basically the way you weigh them. So if you have to say in prohibitions, what's easy, what's hard, I say you tell them about the very hard commandment. Like, for example, you're not allowed to sleep with a married woman. And if you do, the punishment is the Jewish court will execute you after being convicted. And give them an easy commandment. Don't eat pig. Easy. Not so easy when you're starving, but easy on a general level. Right? Those are with regards to prohibitions. Go home tonight and think about the following questions. How do we measure what are easy and hard with regard to positive commandments? Not with the don'ts, but with the do's. There's no punishment there. So, how do we weigh? How do we know if keeping Shabbos is more easier than, I'd say, eating matzah? Two positive commandments. Making Kiddush Friday night and eating matzah. How do we know which is easier and which is harder? How do you measure with regard to negative commandments if they're easy or hard? We said last night, by virtue of the punishment. How grave is the punishment? Not so easy when we speak about the positive commandments. With regard to the positive commandments, how do we know what's easy and what's hard? There's no punishment if you don't do them, so how do you measure it?
Maybe the ones the women are excluded from.
So if I can define that better, you're saying that the ones that not all of Israel are obligated in are maybe easier, because not every single Jew is obligated in. Not just mitzvot that women are excluded from, but let's say mitzvot that we are excluded from. What mitzvot are we excluded from that Moshe is not? For example, duchening. We don't have to duchen. You have got to duchen. That's a positive commandment. We don't got to do that. And therefore, maybe those commandments in which not all of the Jewish people are obligated in might be easier. What other yardstick could be used? With regard to positive commandments, how would you know, how would Lewis know that Kiddush is less problematic, less severe than sitting in a sukkah and eating?
How would Lewis know?
No, I'm serious. Lewis is coming. He doesn't know. So how would you know? How do you know what's more severe and what's less severe? What's more severe, going through a red light or parking in a spot past 2 hours?
Well,
there's no punishment here. So how would you measure it?
Well, the red light is it's a greater cause of danger than parking in 2 hours.
You
have to check your
eyes. That's an excellent point,
Mr. Sadowski. I think it's an excellent point,
Mr.
Sadowski. But Irving, it's very, very difficult to try to pinpoint what are considered, as Talmud says in the Masechet Yevamot, page 47, what's considered easy, what's considered hard. After all, the mitzvot and the mitzvot, in general, they're hard. As everybody knows, the normal saying is, it's shverer to be a Yid, it's hard to be a Jew. Every mitzvah is hard. So what's easy? Very hard to define. Very, very hard to define. I'll just give you one thing to think about. The Rambam Maimonides, in his interpretation to the Pirkei Avot, that many Jews say between Pesach and Shavuos and throughout the summer for some, it says there you have to be very careful to do the easy mitzvot like you do the hard mitzvot. So he defines what's a hard mitzvah. A hard mitzvah is not eating pig. A hard mitzvah are things that are grave. What's an easy mitzvah? Very interesting. What does he say an easy mitzvah is? Learning and speaking in Hebrew. I didn't know it was a mitzvah until the Rambam said it. The Rambam said learning and speaking Hebrew is a mitzvah, but an easy mitzvah. So that's an easy mitzvah. I don't know. I don't know. Is it easy for Boris to speak Hebrew fluently? I don't know. I don't think it's easy for anyone in this room to speak Hebrew easily. You have to break your teeth. I know Hebrew. I still have to break my teeth sometimes. It's not so easy. Read an ancient Hebrew text. You think it's easy? You think it's easy to decipher a page of Talmud? It's not so easy. It's very, very difficult. Whatever it is, when a convert comes to learn, he can't tell him everything for a very simple reason. Do you know everything? Jack Novak's been a Jew from birth. Does he know everything? No! No! Yes, I took in a very extreme example.
In his opinion or your opinion?
In Jack Novak's opinion, I don't think he know everything. As a matter of fact, I don't think there's a rabbi around alive that knows everything. Why? It's too much. But what's the difference? What do you tell him? You tell him a little bit of this and you tell him a little bit of that. You give him an overview. And tomorrow we're going to go into the last part of the overview, which is the most interesting. But ultimately, a convert comes, if you teach him everything, you won't finish, and he won't finish, or she won't finish. It's too long. You can never get a course that comprehends everything in the Torah, all the what-ifs and let's-says. Even if you teach him the laws of Shabbos, you think you'll be able in one course to tell him every what-if and let's-say on Shabbos? Let's say you do this by virtue of a timer that comes from here, and then a non-Jewish hand is coming in through the window, and at the same time, something's going on the bottom. Obviously, you tell him an overview. And the idea here in the Talmud is a little bit of an overview. Easy, hard. Give him an overview. Get him a feeling of what it means to be a Jew. And then at that point, you go and tell him the last part of the crash course. What's the last part of the crash course? And we'll end with this tonight, and I want you to think about it till tomorrow. You tell him a few of the prohibitions, a few of the easy commandments, a few of the hard commandments. Let me find a place. But it would still... Got it. Umodi'in oto avon leket shichecha upeyah umaser shinit. Anybody ready for that one? I translate. And you tell him a little bit about the laws of tithing your fruits. In Israel, you got to give a few of your portions to the Kohen, to the Levi. You got to also give some of the portions by taking the money and eating it in Jerusalem in sanctity. You got to tell them those mitzvot. Let me ask you a very serious question. You're telling them an overview of Judaism. The little mitzvah that in the land of Israel, you got to take off a little tomatoes and give it to the Kohen, that should be in the overview course for a convert? I'm serious. Well, that should be. Moshe has an interest. A very important interest. Okay. Gentlemen, what does this have to do with the overview? You tell them the punishments of the mitzvah that you don't do, I understand. A few of this, a few of that, I understand. What is so important to tell them about leaving a little portion of your field for the poor people to have?
Because it's tzedakah. And tzedakah is the most important.
It's not just tzedakah. You have to remember something, Moshe. One of the mitzvot is Maaser Sheni, and Maaser Sheni. Maaser Sheni means that you basically take the worth of your fruit, you take it to Jerusalem, you buy fruits and vegetables, you buy a home meal, and you eat it in Jerusalem in sanctity. So it's not tzedakah, it's for you. So not everything here is under the rubric, I would say, of tzedakah. Most are. But with all due respect to the mitzvot in Judaism, don't you find fasting on Yom Kippur a little more important than tzedakah? Don't you find not even chametz on Pesach a little more important than tzedakah? I would personally. I would teach Shema Yisrael a little bit of the prayer service, a little Shabbos, a little holidays, meat and milk, family purity. You know, what if these things I wouldn't even think of teaching? Why are they so important that they have to be on the course? Why is it important to tell the convert that part of your produce and your money has to go here or there or the other thing? I understand the need to have an overview for a convert. Because you can't teach everyone everything. Nobody knows everything. The question is, what do you include within the crash course? So I understand the few prohibitions of the Torah, the punishment for not keeping it, positive commandments, negative commandments, overview. And then it says you have to teach them one more thing. What is it? The law that if you're plowing a field and you're harvesting a field, you have to leave a little portion over for the poor. That's one law. You have to also tell them about the law that you have to give some of your money to charity. Interesting, you know? This is what you have to teach a convert right at the onset. These are small little details within a very big system. Why are these laws so important, so vital, that no conversion can take place without telling them, by the way, you have to give certain parts of your salary, of your produce, of your income to the poor? Why? Why is this so vital? And in my opinion, it's vital for one simple reason. To be a Jew is very difficult, yes, everybody says it. However, there's one thing in Judaism that, in my opinion, no other religion has, and that is the constant need to dig into your pocket in order to be a Jew. I mean, let's face it, other religions have festive meals they have to eat throughout the year, here and there. We every week, Shabbos, three meals. A lot of money is invested in that. You think kosher meat is cheap? Absolutely not. Comes along Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur time, you're going to get a phone call. JNF, UIA, UJA, you got to contribute money. Not because it's charity, but rather it's tzedakah, from the word tzedek, justice. It's an absolute obligation to give this money. You go on and on throughout the year. Let's think about how we all go bankrupt once a year because God decided that our kitchens are not all trade. To be a Jew is an expensive business. Okay, the 10% that you give a church is probably the 10% you're left with after being a Jew for a year. To think about the expenses just for Pesach and for a lulav and etrog and to give contributions to various needs. It's an absolutely expensive business to be a Jew. And that's definitely an inherent part of being Jewish, and therefore you tell the convert right at the outset, these are part of the laws of Judaism. It has to do with your pocket, and that's a very important aspect. It's not enough to give into the charity box once a week. It's an inherent part of Judaism, that in order to eat 8 days a year, you have to spend endless amounts of hundreds of dollars in order to get kosher for Pesach food, and so on and so forth. Everybody knows how expensive day schools are, and we continue from that exact point. Now, what do you do at that point? You told them all about that, you told them all about the punishments in Jewish law, you gave them an overview, and now what? No, not yet. It can't be that easy. Omrim lo, you say to him, Ave yodea, you should know. Sha'ad shelo batalin midadzo achal tachele v'yatal nesh karet. Chirat ha-shabbat yatal nesh skila. Until now, every Shabbos, you got up in the morning, you went to work, there was no punishment. Why? A non-Jew does not have to keep Shabbos. Never written in any book that a non-Jew has to keep Shabbos. We're the only religion alive that says you don't have to gain salvation by becoming Jewish. You can take 7 Noahide commandments and you're a good person in front of God and you'll get to the same heaven the Jew will get to if he keeps all the 613. But now, if you go ahead and continue your original lifestyle by going to work on Shabbos and using your car and whatnot, end of the story, you will be liable. And that's basically a basic truth, and you tell them you're going to change your status now by becoming a convert. And now comes, and if the convert is not scared by the prospect that eating on a certain day of the year, I mean, the convert every day gets up in the morning, he eats breakfast. One day of the year, he eats breakfast, and he happens to do it as usual, what's the punishment? And which day am I talking about? Yom Kippur, he gets up and eats. Onesh is karet, being cut off from the Jewish nation, an early death. That's terrible. If the convert runs out of the room and cries, you wish him farewell. But if the convert stays in, what do you do then? What should be the next step logically? You tell him about the merit of doing mitzvot. If you don't eat on Yom Kippur, and you don't work on Shabbos, says the Gemara, Modi'im lo scharan shel mitzvot. You tell them about the merit, the prize you're going to get for keeping the mitzvot. First you warn him, if he's willing to take the worst, you tell him worst is over, you also get a great merit. Very good. Now, comes along and you continue and you say, listen, the world to come is a place where you'll go to if you go to keep 7 Noahide commandments. Now you're obligating yourself on all these commandments and that's the only way to get there. You're willing? He says yes. Fine. What happens if he's willing to do all this? Look what it says. I'm going to read you the words for words because you're going to think I'm going to mess it up. Ein marbin alav, ve'ein medaktikim alav. Don't tell him too much, and don't test them on too much. What does that mean? You're giving this guy a comprehensive overview of Judaism. That's what the Gemara is telling you. It basically tells you exactly what to teach him in the course. Now, eventually, you see you have an authentic convert. I'm going to read to you exactly. Do not dissuade and do not persuade. Don't be crazy. This is another word for me to understand. Use common sense. This is not written in any law book. A rabbi, or to be more precise, a Jewish court, must have common sense to know and to feel. This person is an authentic person to want to become Jewish, and this person does not authentically want to become Jewish. And we'll just end with this story, and then we'll dive in my rib. Gentlemen, there was once a convert, a true story, and other people involved. She basically learned with the rabbi for a whole year. This is in New Jersey. The rabbi was basically very much at the end, and the rabbi very naturally, in one of his classes, maledicts Jesus. I don't know why, happened to come up, said, I don't believe in the divinity of Jesus. This girl starts to cry. Well, as everyone can understand, that's exactly what the Gemara is telling us. He should not be persuaded or dissuaded too much. This is a case where obviously this person was not willing to throw off her former faith to believe in the divinity of Jesus, and therefore, very naturally, obviously, she was not converted. Unfortunately, this was on the eve of the conversion. What can you do? She continued to try, and unfortunately, every subsequent rabbi that came to that community, of course, did not allow it for that same reason. Obviously, to accept all this, to change your status from being someone that's not obligated in mitzvot to being obligated in mitzvot, is a very big change. And therefore, you have to be extremely sure, and yet when you're sure, don't ask too many questions. Yes, Jack? I asked too many questions.
It gets you to know what's in the mind of a convert, and it gets you to know what's in the heart of a convert. And everything you talked about deals with the mind. How do you deal with the heart?
How do you deal with the heart? I have to say, there's no good answer. The only thing I can say is common sense. See what you can do to try to understand that we're talking about someone authentic who want to become part of the Jewish nation, see how active they want to become. Obviously, this is not written anywhere. It's written in a book that's never been written called Situation Ethics. And these situation ethics are very much the feeling that you have at that moment. It's very much, in my opinion, and we'll end with this, like a feeling you have when you decided to engage your wife. As much as the logical reasons were out there, when you decided to be engaged to your specific wife, it was a feeling of the heart as much as of the mind. And it was very hard to explain the feeling of the heart as you felt this is the right girl for you. You want to wake up next to this girl every day of your life. Very difficult.
What are the consequences?
Oh, consequences of making a mistake. We'll get into that next week, the consequences of making a mistake. All I'm going to tell you right now is the following words, and then we'll end. As soon as you find all this out, Malina told me, you give him a bris right away. What do you mean right away? Let's wait a few days. Why right away? Why is it so important to get him in then? When you're totally sure, do it right away. Don't detain. Why? How can it be that after this whole process of the convert ultimately says, I accept upon myself all the mitzvot of the Torah. And at that point, they go into the mikvah, and he comes out, or she comes out, a Jew. How can they make that declaration when they don't even know what's entailed? What did we learn last week? What do you teach the convert? Do you teach the convert all the 613 commandments? No. A little of this, a little of that, an overview here, an overview there. You make a point of mentioning it's expensive to be a Jew. We've learned that together as well. But ultimately, there wasn't a real comprehensive understanding of what Judaism entails. You ask a convert today who went through this whole process, you ask a convert today, what do you do in a case in which you have a milichic knife that cut a piece of meat? Do you think the convert's going to know the answer? No? What's the probability the convert learned that detail of the laws of milk and meat? What's the probability? What do you say, Laurie? I'd say zero to none. Absolutely. I'll give you a little secret. Most Jews from birth don't know the answer. Why do you think they pay a rabbi? That's a detail that's actually a requirement on all rabbinic ordinations exams, as far as I know, because those are very minute details, very various considerations involved. What's the status of the knife? What's the status of the meat? Very, very complex situations. I don't think the convert learned it. So how can the convert go into the mikvah and say, hey, I accept upon myself all the mitzvot? She or he didn't learn all the mitzvot. That's like saying to yourself, I accept upon myself all the responsibilities of being Prime Minister of Canada when you don't even bother to read the book. Come on! You don't give a driver a license unless they actually were tested. How can you let a convert make that declaration? Is he making or she making a farce? Is that what Judaism is telling us to do? Yes, Mark, what do you suggest?
Now, seven Ishmaelites. If the convert is a Jew who stood beside us at Har Sinai, then he's going through exactly what you went through.
Well,
accepting, then he'll learn it afterwards. First, he'll agree to it. The fine print.
Mark is saying something very interesting. Mark is saying that ultimately every convert goes through what the Jewish nation once went through when we all became Jews. When do we become Jews? Namely, obligated in a Jewish lifestyle. Yeah, we're all sons of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but ultimately, at Sinai, what did we do? Did we do a bris? Yes. Did we actually say we accept upon ourselves all the mitzvot? Yes. So ultimately, the convert goes through the same stages. As a matter of fact, there's one stage we don't do today, and that's what's called Hatzat Korban. You have to bring a sacrifice. We don't have sacrifices today. At Mount Sinai, they brought sacrifices. So ultimately, what Mark is saying is, ultimately, every convert is going through the same revelation at Sinai in a very minute, minimized version that we all went through personally. We all became Jews by doing a bris, Abraham's legacy to us. We're going to read about it in this week's Parsha of Lech Lecha. We all became Jews by saying, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do, we will accept, and then we'll learn. And we all became Jews by going into the mikvah. So ultimately, what this convert is going through is what we all went through. And that's maybe what the Gemara is trying to tell us. Ultimately, you can't teach a convert everything. I can promise you, you can't even teach a Jew everything. I don't know everything. I don't think Phil knows everything. And yet, there is absolutely a willingness to accept. And that brings me to my next point. In my opinion, what the Gemara is telling us is, you have to go and say, I am willing to accept and fulfill the minute I find out. That's a very important declaration. Yeah, I know approximately what Judaism is all about. Milk and meat, and Shabbos, and Yontif, and I know a little bit about the punishments, and a little bit about the positive commandments. I mean, an overview Sam will give him, right? An overview he has. So then he says, I understand approximately what's involved. And the woman or the man will say, I accept upon myself this lifestyle. And whatever I don't know yet, I will learn. And what, do you think I'm worse than any other Jew? What do you think Lu's ancestor did at Sinai? What, he knew the whole Torah? No! Lu's great. I'll keep on talking for the next 10 minutes, but my earth is coming. Lu's grandfather, whatever it might be, to the 15,000th power at Mount Sinai said, I accept upon myself the whole Torah. You think he knew the whole Torah? He couldn't even ask his neighbor about the whole Torah because nobody knew. There was a willingness to accept, a willingness to know. And this, God willing, will explain for the rest of the week as we go on how indeed we accept this convert, even though the convert doesn't know all about the Torah. There's a willingness to accept, even without knowing about it. And basically, that declaration is saying, when I find out, I will accept and I will fulfill. Had I known, I would have done it. What that declaration is trying to eliminate is the situation where they say, had I known, I wouldn't have become Jewish. That declaration is saying, I am now totally freeing the rabbi from all liabilities. The rabbi taught me the overview, I understand, I accept, and ultimately I'm liable. I'm liable. The minute I come out of the mikvah, I'm liable. But ultimately the point is very clear. You can accept upon yourself all the obligations, even without knowing, as long as there's a willingness to fulfill. How does the convert say that he or she accepts upon themselves all the Torah laws when they don't even know probably a mere half of them? How? It's only an overview. We explain. Every single Jew was in that situation once upon a time. What did we say? We said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen. Which basically means we have the willingness to accept the Torah, to do everything in it. And afterwards we'll hear about it. Even before hearing about it, if I know what I'm doing is wrong, I will stop. And therefore we gave the example. A convert, let's say, learns about the laws of Shabbos in an overview. And Shabbos sits in his house or her house. They find out that they can't do this or they can't do that. They stop doing it. They didn't know about it beforehand. It doesn't impinge on their conversion. The truth of the matter is, as long as there's a willingness to fulfill, that's good enough for a conversion. So ultimately, to sum up what we said until now, a convert must go through the following stages. A, We warn the convert about Judaism. First of all, being part of the Jewish nation might arouse more enemies than lovers. After all, anti-Semitism has been around for a while. B, there's many Torah laws that you now have to fulfill. If you decide not to be part of the Jewish nation, God will never punish you, because a Gentile, a non-Jew, is not obligated in these laws. So, but if you decide to become part of the Jewish nation, you will be absolutely liable for these particular commandments, doing them and not doing them, and all the punishments that involve. We give him, thirdly, an overview of Judaism. So far, an overview of what it means to be a Jew, anti-Semitism and whatnot, an overview of the fact that there's no obligation to be a Jew, and finally, if they go through those two stages, you actually tell them what Judaism is all about. Ultimately, that overview is good enough. However, you must also tell them, as the Gemara says, that it's expensive to be a Jew, as we said many times. Kosher meat, tuition, Pesach, it's not an easy situation. The 10% you give in a charity box in church is probably what you're left with at the end of the year if you're a Jew. Ultimately, it's a very big business. And finally, if they go through all those steps, we have to, of course, if it's a boy, give him a bris when he heals from a bris. And I have to say today just one word about this. A bris for an adult I once thought was the most traumatic experience in the world, until I saw it with my own eyes. It's done today in a hospital, first of all. Local anesthetic is good enough, as surprising as that sounds. Local anesthetic, and the person goes to work the same day. I've seen it. It's an amazing thing. But thank God today, it's not as traumatic as you may have thought. Yes, we're talking about a very sensitive part of your anatomy. Yes, we're not talking about an experience anyone volunteers for. But ultimately, it's not as traumatic as you may think. Many Russian Olim that came to Israel went through it. And I can promise you, because you know in communist Russia, it was a big problem to get a bris. It was against the law and whatnot. Ultimately, it was done, and it's not a traumatic experience like I thought it was. I've seen it with my own eyes, and I can tell you it's not as traumatic as we may think. Now, one more word. In Western countries, certain Western countries, there's always been a debate if a bris, namely circumcision, removing the foreskin, happens to be healthy or unhealthy, regardless of religion. Is it a healthy thing to remove the foreskin or not? And in many hospitals, very naturally, in the third day, the fourth day after birth, doctors go around and remove the foreskin. Now, if you're a Jew, you have to do it by a moel, eighth day, it's a Hobbes procedure, you better leave a note that, indeed, don't touch the baby, they're going to have a circumcision. But in other hospitals, many years, they've gone through it. So let's say a person naturally was in a Western hospital, was circumcised as a baby, not by a moel, not in a bris, but rather it was circumcised in a hospital by a doctor, by a non-Jewish doctor. It's not considered an actual act of a mitzvah because it wasn't done by a Jew. Ultimately, 30 years later, this person finds Judaism, decides to become a Jew, and already has a bris. What's the law? He circumcised but had no circumcision. It's a very tough question. In other words, the person is circumcised. What do? The Gemara says what's called hatafat dam brit. What's hatafat dam brit? A Jew has to ultimately poke the person in that part. A little blood comes out, and thus we're finished. That's hatafat dam brit. That's what we do for a baby on the eighth day if the baby was born circumcised. And many babies are born circumcised. Not in my family, not in this community since I've been here, but it does happen. It's called hatafat dam brit. Again, I thought it was traumatic. I've seen it done, and it, believe me, a poke, a little cotton, it's not even as bad as a shot. A shot, I would say, is more traumatic. Ultimately, we're not talking about the most traumatic thing in the world, but we are talking about a sensitive part of the body, and sensitivity is needed, I must say. I'll just give you a story. I was once at a conversion. The person went through a whole year of learning. The conversion, what they did was, the person was already circumcised, so there was a little poke, and that was it. It was very, very simple, fine, and a little piece of cotton, and then right into the mikvah. There was no problem. I was very surprised about one thing. The rabbi that was doing it was a very experienced rabbi. He didn't wear gloves. Right? He obviously had a synthetic needle, but didn't wear gloves. So I said to him, why don't you wear gloves? He said, if I wore gloves, I'd scare him off. I don't know. I personally feel you should wear gloves in this situation. Anyway, let's finish it off. A convert does either a circumcision or what's called a tafat dam brit, a little poke with a little blood coming out. Then, after he's healed, if he needs to heal, he goes into the mikvah. Obviously, for a woman, everything I just said is irrelevant. A woman, after, of course, going through the initial stages of course, learning about Judaism, everything we said, go into the mikvah, And that's around the end of the conversion. As long as the person says in the mikvah, I accept upon myself all the laws of the Torah, whether I know about them or I don't. When I find out, I will do them and fulfill. Yes? Okay, now I'm going to ask a question. We'll try to answer it. We'll try to answer it briefly. In order to go to the mikvah and be converted, you can't just go alone. You have to have three Jewish judges with you. Judges don't have to be judges that went through judging school. It could be three rabbis, three people that ultimately are related, whatever it might be. Ultimately, three Jews, let's say Shomer Shabbos Jews, that watch you go into the mikvah. Now, for a man to undress in front of a man, not so terrible. Go into the mikvah, if you know you have to go in without your clothes on, nothing separates from you in the water, fine. How do you do that for a woman? No. You have to have three judges. A woman can't be a judge in Jewish law. How do you do it?
She has a bathing suit.
A bathing suit's a problem because it's too tight on the body and therefore the separation between the body and the water. Bathing suit doesn't work. Gentlemen, this is a tough question. You have to think of a good solution.
A sheet.
A sheet? What do you mean a sheet?
A sheet, just loosely.
Where does the sheet go? On the water?
Yeah, it goes in the water.
But the woman's in the water.
It covers the woman.
She's just like a sheet that has a little hole in it. I haven't seen that. I don't think it's very practical because let's say the woman goes under the water and comes up and, you know, not exactly where the hole is. She'll be stuck under water. I wouldn't do it with the sheet. It's not safe. I'll tell you there's a few solutions. The first solution is as follows. The woman goes into the mikvah alone. The men stand outside. And according to some authorities, it's good enough to hear the water. Now, but you hear a woman, you hear, you know the way it is when you dunk. You're in a pool, let's say. You're outside the pool. All of a sudden, someone jumps into the pool. You hear a splash, right? So you hear a splash. You know the woman goes in. You're outside the door. You hear it in the doorway. That's good enough. That's one solution. Another solution? Anybody know? Tell you what they do. The woman first goes into the mikvah, without her clothes on, of course, and she goes in, does a good dunk, and the Jewish judges stand outside, hear the water splashing. Then she puts on a robe. A robe that's not as tight as a bathing suit, and she goes into the water with the robe on. The robe covers her from head to toe, of course, and she goes in, not head to toe, let's say head to the toes, and she goes in with the robe. Once the robe is soaking wet, it's no longer a separation between her and the water, because the water that she's wet with is the water of the mikvah. Then the three rabbis come in, and what's usually done, at least when I did it, I was just the third man, I wasn't involved in the conversion. Ultimately, what happens is you go into the room, the woman's not facing you, that's a little uncomfortable. You go in and the woman's back is to you. And then you speak to her a few minutes and you tell her you accept upon yourself all the mitzvot. Yeah, you say the water is now embracing you like the Jewish nation, like the whole Jewish nation embraces you. And the woman goes in front of the judges see she goes in properly without her hair sticking out, they say mazel tov and they leave the room. Is this a comfortable scenario? What do you say? Not as comfortable as I would like it to be. However, you can ask many converts about that scenario, and I'm sure you're going to get diverse answers. Some hated it, some loved it. Ultimately, there are many women converts. Many of them have converted properly in front of three Jewish judges. And ultimately, at that point of conversion, because it's such an important point, you understand when you come out, you're now a full-fledged Jew. Ultimately, the fact of the matter is, having witnesses there to see it is all the more substantial. But obviously, the laws of modesty must be kept to the fullest extent. Yes, Shelley?
My question is there a prohibition about having, for example, like the Revitzin in the mikvah room with the convert?
No prohibition whatsoever, no. But you still need three male Jewish judges, that's all.
Okay, but I'm not sure that I think it's a great idea for three males and for one woman with the convert in the pool.
I think you have a very legitimate point. I've only been at three conversions my whole life, just to see what it was like. And in all those conversions, we had both the Rebbetzin in the room, as well as the person, let's say, the Jewish person from the community, that basically was with this convert for the entire year, you know, brought him into the house. So absolutely, I think you're bringing up a legitimate point, especially today, with the so-called, I would say, alleged sexual harassments and unfortunately true sexual harassments in the Jewish community that we have to deal with and deal with seriously, is all the more so. And I have to tell you, quite frankly, Shelley, I do not meet with women in the synagogue at night if it's a one-on-one meeting. Unless I know there's another meeting going on. I meet only in my house. My living room, my wife's in the house, my kids are running around, it's a little uncomfortable. Much better than sitting in a synagogue alone with a woman. because of that precaution. And I think precautions have to be taken. Yes?
I was of the understanding that the three judges had to be Shomer, at least Shomer.
A little more than Shomer.
Or they
had
to be. Like,
the qualifications for being a Jewish judge, even for this specific simple act, is a little more than Shomer. Yeah.
I had to bring a rabbi in, because we only had two rabbis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You have to have a rabbi. It's not enough to have Shomer Shabbos. That's correct. That's correct for this particular issue. Gentlemen, as I said, it seems very traumatic this evening, but I have to admit that many convicts went through it and thought it was an amazing spiritual experience. And of course, seeing it firsthand and experiencing firsthand is all the more better than hearing it from me. So ultimately, I definitely would like to hear, if you know converts in the community, outside the community, in your family, hearing how indeed that particular moment was with three rabbis standing there asking you questions, how they felt it was. Now the Talmud says something very, very strange. And I quote, after the whole mikvah, tavau ve'alah, he went down to the mikvah, he immersed, he comes out, harei hu ki Yisrael lechol dvarav. He is now a Jew for all cases and everything, meaning he's a full-fledged Jew. Gentlemen, do we need the Talmud to tell us that? The answer is no. We know this is the way to become Jews. Why does the Talmud tell us that when he comes out of the mikvah, she comes out of the mikvah, they are full-fledged Jews? Ultimately, this was said in the study hall. As you know, a Talmud page is ultimately the live protocol of the debate in the study hall. So I'm sure a guy was standing there in the study hall, the rabbis are sitting around, and he gave this whole description. Everyone said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he ended the description by saying, and once he comes out of the mikvah, this person's a full-fledged Jew. Some rabbi got up and said, what are you coming? You're inventing America here. Of course it's a full-fledged Jew. What are you telling us this for? Talmud answers, why? Anybody can guess? Just in case he has second thoughts. A person comes out of the mikvah, I can tell you once again, after being there three times only, but three times that are very substantial, I think, ultimately, that is an amazing experience. A woman or a man, I was once for a man, two for a woman, and ultimately, this is an amazing experience. Both for me, meaning for the judges, and for the person becoming Jewish. They come out of there, we have a l'chaim, we eat something together, they make the first bracha as a Jew. It's an amazing emotional experience. I've never experienced something so amazing. That's great. That's the day you go to the mikvah. Life goes on. Life goes on. And this convert looks at the famous Jews in the world. Who are the famous Jews in the world? I'm not the famous Jew. I'm a good Jew. I try to do all the mitzvot. I'm not in the paper. Who are the famous Jews in the world? Let's go through them. Let's think. Einstein wasn't a religious Jew, didn't do all the mitzvot. Oh, okay. You know, maybe I'll be like Einstein. I'd love to be as famous as Einstein. Shimon Peres, is Shimon Peres famous? Of course he's famous. Every statesman knows Shimon Peres doesn't go to shul on Yom Kippur, so maybe I don't have to go to shul on Yom Kippur. Maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong, who knows? It could very well be, says this convert, why do I have to continue to do everything I said I'm going to do? If to be famous, you don't need it. And therefore, I got second thoughts. Maybe I don't have to do everything. Maybe, you know, eating kosher was good, but it doesn't make the Jew. Ultimately, they taught me about Jewishness. I have second thoughts. Or, give you a case scenario. A convert converted before Passover. Everybody knows Passover is beautiful. Shavuos is gorgeous. Rosh Hashanah tastes good. Great. Comes December. With all due respect, our little minical, little shtickle at Hanukkah can't compete with Christmas dinner back home. That point, December, is the breaking point. Oh, can't do it. Latkes doesn't compete with the turkey back home with the tree and the presents. Oy vey. Gentlemen, if this convert says it, does it make a difference? Answer is no. Absolutely not. And that's what the Talmud is coming to tell us. Once they come out of the mikvah, they're full-fledged Jews, and they're liable for everything they do, and it can't be washed off. I knew a guy back home in Israel. He was an African-American. He was a true convert, what we call in Hebrew Ger Tzedek. He converted, he walks around with his tzitzit sticking out, comes to Minyan three times a day. I learned pages of Talmud with him together. Study in a local class, wonderful person, has a family, a wonderful family. Believe me, the kids are in very important, the kids are in ultra-day schools, wonderful, great guy. He once told me a beautiful thing. He said, you see my skin, everybody asks who I am. They think I'm an Ethiopian, because many, as you know, Jews from Ethiopia made Aliyah to Israel. All of a sudden, I start speaking a fluent New York and English. They understand I'm not Ethiopian. They all want to know about me. And it gets annoying. Rabbi said to me, I'd love to wash it off. You can't wash it off. And that's exactly what the Talmud means. We learned this sage together. You can't wash off the Jewishness. Once you come out of the mikvah, it's there to stay, and whether you like it or not. And that's what the Talmud is coming to teach us in this particular passage. You can't wash it off. Ultimately, you have to deal with it. And that person that has second thoughts, obviously, we try as much as possible to outreach to. But then again, at that point, they are like any other Jew that decides to have to come to Mincha tonight. They're like any other Jew that decides to come to Shul once a year, whatever it might be. But ultimately, these precious Jews are precious Jews, and we have to do everything possible to outreach to them. But it doesn't impinge in any way in their conversion. Their conversion was absolutely unequivocally authentic. Now, we'll end with a question tonight, and we'll answer it tomorrow night. Let's say it's not a year later. Didn't wait till December. This person was in the mikvah and said, I'm going to put one over the rabbis. I don't mean what I'm saying. Never meant it. To paraphrase it, they go to the mikvah, they say mazel tov, they drink a l'chaim, and where do they go celebrate? They go to celebrate at the local lobster joint. That night. Is that person a true convert? Is that person a full-fledged Jew? Is that person an absolute Jew who just happened to go off the path we have to outreach to? Or maybe not. Meaning not a person that a year later had second thoughts, 2 years later, 10 years later, but at that point, the mikvah, we have reason to believe that they pulled one over the rabbi. We'll give you another case. How many cases? You all know the cases. I'm not trying to be Christopher Columbus here. I didn't find America. Gentlemen, you have a person that wanted to convert. They spend a year learning. They spent another half a year trying to make arrangements. 2 years later, they went into the mikvah. They're full-fledged Jews. These persons can't be found today. They live in Halifax. We can't find them. We don't know where they are. They're not members of our shul. They're not members of any other shul. They're not in the AJC directory. We don't know where they are. Is this person a true convert or not? Do we have reason to believe that at that point when they said, I accept upon myself all the mitzvah like any other Jew, was that a true statement or not? That's a very loaded question. We have arrived at the crux of the problems of conversion today. Once upon a time, there was no problem. And I'll explain it later. Today, endless problems. We ended up last night with the words of the Gemara. The Gemara says, once a person goes through the entire conversion process, and we went through what it is, this person comes out of the mikvah, he's an absolutely complete Jew. The Gemara asks, why do you need to say that? Everybody knows, you come out of the mikvah, you're a complete Jew. Gemara answers, because maybe this person may go to shul on Shabbos. This person may go to shul the first Shabbos after conversion. Love it. Rosh Hashanah, beautiful. Yom Kippur, superb. Sukkot, even better. Simchas Torah, you can't get happier than that. Comes along December. Second thoughts. This man, what can you do? He misses the Christmas tree, decides to throw it off. As we said last night, and I gave the example of my good friend, the African-American who became a true convert to Judaism, he told me, just like my skin, you can't wash it off. You became a Jew, you can't wash it off. This person becomes a full-fledged member in the local church, full-fledged Jew in many ways. The Gemara gives a wonderful example. To paraphrase it, if this person came back to shul after a while, just for a bar mitzvah, sees a beautiful girl, he's unmarried, takes a Hershey bar, goes up to the girl and says, you want the Hershey bar? She says, yes. Anyone that grew up in New York knows what a Hershey bar is to a New Yorker. Gives her the Hershey bar and says, Arayat Mekudeshet Libet Abad Zukadat Moshe B'Yisrael. Everyone knows what that means, right? Translating from Chinese, you are barat to me with this particular Hershey bar, Kedat Moshe B'Yisrael. Just in accordance with the Torah laws, the girl accepts it. It's five witnesses of the Jewish people there because it's after shul. The girl is married to a Jew with all that entails.
How does a Hershey bar?
You can get married by virtue of any piece of worth, including a Hershey bar. It's Today we use a ring customarily, but a Hershey bar works. This recorder will work. These watches will work.
75-cent Hershey bar.
Where do you think the Cracker Jack with the ring came from? That was the stringent position of the Hasidic Jews. I'm joking. The overly stringent Jews, they wanted to give something of worth, Cracker Jack, and a ring. So they put it in the Cracker Jack box, and they gave it. Forget about it. This is a long
story. Hold on. If you turn the Cracker Jack box upside down, open the bottom, you get the ring out without having to go to the
Cracker Jack. Good point. Good point.
So what's the worth?
What's the worth? Any piece of worth. The Gemara says this person wants to throw off Judaism, it makes no difference. We assume this person is a Jew, full-fledged Jew, even if after a year after conversion, the person doesn't fulfill one mitzvah. But we ended off last night with a fascinating question the Gemara doesn't deal with. Let's say we have reason to believe that at the moment of conversion, they didn't mean it. Very simple example. A person goes through a conversion. After the mitzvah, they take the whole family out to a party because they're full-fledged Jews. Where do they go for a party? They don't go to Mendy's. They go to Murray's Lobsters. Can you say that was a good conversion? No? Or do you say the whole thing is one bluffery, one fakery? It's an absolute outrage and a scandal and a fake. No? Gemara seems to say, comes out of the mikvah, Hareyu ki Yisrael lechol dvarav, comes out of the mikvah, full-fledged Jew. But the person right after he comes out of the mikvah, a day later, that 2 minutes later, goes out to eat a lobster. No? When they were in the mikvah and they said, I fulfill and I absolutely declare that I'm going to fulfill all the mitzvot of the Torah. Is that authentic? Gentlemen, this is why today conversion is one of the issues on the world agenda. Why? Because today it's fashionable to be a Jew like all the rest of the Jews. What does that mean? Who is the famous Jews today in the world?
Madonna.
A Jew, okay. The fact that you call yourself Esther doesn't make you a Jew. And the fact that you make a song about the Ari and have the audacity to sing it doesn't make you a Jew.
She
didn't convert either. Absolutely not. No, gentlemen, give me an example of the famous Jews in the past. Yes, the Labor Party had primaries yesterday. Amir Peretz won. Shimon Peretz lost for the 15th time in his life. That's in the news. So who's in the news? Jews that fulfill every mitzvah, or Jews that fulfill some of the mitzvahs? No. The Jews that are fulfilling some of the mitzvahs, that are also politicians, half of them are corrupt, those are the Jews that are in the news. Believe me, I wasn't in the news today. I tried to fulfill all the mitzvahs. Irwin came to Minyan this morning. No one wrote about that. Victor came after a hard day's work to Mincha. No one wrote about that. That doesn't make the news. So this conference says, I want to be like the famous Jews. That, as the Gemara says, is okay. If that's afterwards. But at the moment of conversion, if we have reason to believe that the declaration, I will fulfill all the commandments, was a fake, what do you do? What's the problem? On the one hand, who can prove it was a fake? We don't know what's in your heart. Maybe something happened afterwards. You saw the famous Jews are people that don't fulfill mitzvot, it's fine. On the other hand, at that moment, you may have thought it was authentic. But, look, the minute after you go to the mikvah, you don't celebrate at Mendy's, you celebrate at Murray's, and you don't exactly eat a corned beef sandwich with a pickle on the side and good normal sauerkraut like every good Jew should eat, but rather you eat a ham sandwich with a little lobster on the side. How can we say it's an authentic conversion? No. This gentleman will explain to you, and we'll end with this evening, why conversion today is an issue. Because ultimately, unfortunately, it's very easy today to fake people. And if you fake them, you don't know if they're faking. Maybe 10 days later, they had a change of heart. If it's a day later, well, a day later, they had a change of heart, they're still Jews. But if at that moment they had a change of heart, they're not Jews. How are you going to prove it? This is a primary issue. Once upon a time, there wasn't an issue. If you're crazy, as Ben-Gurion said in the Knesset, they once in the 50s wanted to know who is a Jew. So Ben-Gurion got up in the Knesset and said, who is a Jew? Whoever's stupid enough to want to be a Jew. Quote from Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister of the state of Israel. Once upon a time, you wanted to be stupid enough to become part of the Jewish nation, then ultimately, believe me, you meant it. Today, there could be other ulterior motives that maybe it's in your best interest to become part of a Jewish nation that has a few better connections in business. that maybe has a few better connections that are good for you, good for your family, whatever it might be. You want your kids to be in the Hebrew school. Whatever the reasons may be, it's attractive to some people. Don't ask me why it's attractive to come to Minyan every day, but Michael, apparently there are people out there, they want to be counted for Minyan. It's important to them. So they want to go into the mikvah so we could say 9, 10, up, Ashrei. Gentlemen, this is why today conversion is an issue. And therefore today it's not a simple issue. And ultimately books and books and books have been written about it in order to try to solve those problems. The problems are endless. If I just try to begin to think of the responsive literature on problems that came up of this person and that person who remarries and doesn't remarry, endless issues. But I don't think the answer should be, then let's not do anything. No. If we say, let's put up our hands, it's too many problems, let's not do it, then ultimately we're closing the door to the authentic converts that want to become part of the Jewish nation and authentically love the Jewish nation, authentically want to fulfill mitzvot. We have to find ways to authenticate, and we also have to find ways to jot out the fakes. Yeah?
Someone converts proper, full conversion.
Yes.
Everything's hunky dory, 2 years down the road. They have,
change of heart.
Do they have to convert or be baptized back to Christianity?
I don't know. You have to ask the Christians.
It's, you know, it's based on what the new people want. You want to go back to where you were in the church. You never stop being Christian.
In Judaism, once you become a Jew, you can never wash it off. I don't know how it works in other areas. I don't know.